Part 5, Teaching with Learning in Mind.
We have already learned a lot about how we should teach if we want to be called learner-centered teachers. But I asked Sandy and Ian whether they had any more advice about good teaching, about teaching with learning in mind. This is what they told me.
The teacher's main role is about taking our learners from the known to the unknown. It is about connecting with everyday experience through frames, through schema, through new ways of seeing the world to help them to move from where they are to new ways of seeing the world and acting in the world that relate to the demands of the world, and providing the scaffolding, in other words, mediating that process in various ways, using various strategies to help them move from the one position to the other. And I think that includes touching their heart and their minds. And that's where I think the everyday experiences are important, because I think they touch the heart. I think they help people to see relevance and to feel need and to be motivated. I do think, however, that it's not correct to... that some people in the last few years in South Africa have tended to throw out books, throw out textbooks, throw out theories, and to overemphasize the everyday, and to feel that it's fine just to let people engage with their everyday experiences and that that in itself will facilitate learning. I don't agree with that. I do think that in order for people to learn, they need to be taken beyond that. And I do think that formal bodies of knowledge developed in schools and other places help to do that. And they're crucial in that process of mediation. But I do think that we've got to find a way to put that together in all areas of formal education.
Within our everyday or taken for granted ways of knowing, there are certain things that will act as barriers to further learning. Like the boy in the Socrates example, okay? I mean, he had a particular idea about how area works, the area of a square. He was convinced that he was right and refused emotionally and could not cognitively see his way out of that particular way of knowing. Now, what he had to do from Socrates as the teacher's point of view was to unlearn those particular mathematical constructs that happened to be wrong. And of course, what Socrates did, because of his particular theory of learning, which was that somewhere in that boy's head there was the inborn knowledge that would allow him to arrive at some kind of understanding of the truth, he engaged in a questioning process which he believed would unlock those ways of knowing. And suddenly the boy would say, "Man, I got it wrong, you know, I'm sorry." And that barrier would be overcome. But left to himself, the boy would never have got beyond those barriers, those misunderstandings, those things that needed to be unlearned.
Let me just see if I get this right, to go back to your idea of putting in place a different system. I mean, in a sense, what Socrates was doing then was that in the form of his teaching, he was putting into the learner's head. He was doing two things. One was that he was asking questions which assisted the boy in unlearning. But the boy unlearned, to use a terrible term, by realizing that there was a different system. There was a different way in which you could calculate it. So, yeah,
he started to think within a new form of geometry.
Okay. Yeah. Now, one of the things you seemed to signal earlier on was. And you said that, look, there are lots of ways of knowing, and they have their role to play, and that teach that in a sense, even formal schooling must use learners' experience. But you seem to be suggesting that they must use it in a particular kind of way. So, you seem to be saying that you can't move from the experience to the more abstract, which I think people often say, you know, start with the learner's experience and then develop the abstract.
Yeah.
Why would you have problems with that? And what is the alternative to that?
What the learning paradox, remember, says is, if you don't know something, there's no way you can understand that there's something you do not know. So the idea that you can move from what you know, slowly, systematically, step by step, to something that you don't know, is part of that paradox. And the argument that Vygotskians, for example, put, is to say, no, sorry, you've got to first of all develop a systematized way of knowing that is different to your taking for granted everything. Only then will the bridges be built that will make it possible for you to move beyond the known. Let's look at the example of learning an unfamiliar language, a language that is not our own natal tongue. What we do when we learn our own languages, and of course we learn our own languages if you like, very spontaneously as very young children. But what we do is we acquire a set of understandings about what counts as forms of expression or even grammatical rules that we try and apply. And when we encounter another language, very often we've got those inbuilt ideas about what a language should sound like. Okay, and we encounter in the new language different ways of expressing things. And what you see in people who are acquiring new languages is very often they experience barriers to learning the new language, because what they're trying to do is apply the rules that are familiar from their own language in learning the new language. And there are a lot of language educators who say, look, you've got to actually immerse the learner in another system of rules, so to speak, entirely in the new language, and let people practice within it. Let them break out of and move beyond their taken-for-granted ideas about what language should be.
I spoke to Jill and Maggie discussing the same question. They work with teachers in classrooms on a daily basis, and as you may have noticed, have lots of really good examples to illustrate their ideas. This is how our discussion went.
What do you understand by learning? And what are some of the, I suppose, misconceptions about how learning occurs in your experience?
One of the misconceptions is that because schooling has failed many people, there's a tendency to swing and say that all learning must be comfortable, all learning must be fun. Well, all learning isn't fun. It should be interesting, it should be stimulating, it should motivate you to want to find out more things, but it doesn't all have to be fun. And I think that's one of the problems that we're dealing with, is how do we motivate kids in school when learning's not really that easy.
For teachers, I think what we need to do is to get a balance of making it acceptable to the students' level of functioning, but at the same time making it entertaining. So that balance is what teachers struggle with often.
Yeah.
So you try and create an activity that would challenge learners at different levels, depending on where they are. Okay, and that's kind of the teacher being in that gap, functioning between taking the learners to where she would like to take them, but at the same time recognizing that they bring information at different levels to the task.
Okay. But what you seem to be saying then is you must use what learners bring with them. How do you use that? Can it be a problem to use what learners bring? Do learners bring misunderstandings? What do you do with that?
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they bring concepts that have been learned from home, from everyday experiences. I'm thinking here in particular with learners who come to school having been told that if there's a lightning that struck somebody, that someone has been bewitched and that someone has sent the lightning. Obviously, that kind of misconception has to be changed. But it's not often for the teacher to say what you know is wrong, but rather to provide the scientific information and then for the students to weigh the two. And often they would reject what they feel does not go with what they're learning at the moment.
Okay.
I mean, I think that the concept that one uses there is to provoke some conflict. And one doesn't do that by assertion. You must learn this concept. It is by activity, I think. Here's a very sweet example, which actually happened in a lower grade class. I think it was a second grade. They're starting with division. And the teacher asked, I think it was 12 divided by 3. Many kids answered 4, and one kid answered 1.5. Okay, now that's, one could say, typically in mathematics, you'd see teachers going then for the 4's the right answer, end of the story. But this teacher said, how did you get 1.5? Okay, and the child said, well, a half of 12 is 6, and a half of 6 is 3, and a half of 3 is 1.5. Okay, so that child's conception of dividing by 3 was that you halve it 3 times. Now, that's not something that's an error. That's another concept. It's quite an interesting one in many ways. That one can think about all kinds of divisions one can do in that way. And the teacher actually had quite a long struggle to get the kid to relinquish that conception of division. And what they did is that they did a lot of sharing activities. Okay, so we've got 12 cents, or we've got 12 rand, and there are 3 of us, and we want to share it out. How many? Are you going to be happy to get 1 rand 50? So in that way, to try to provoke some conflict with the idea, to take on the mathematical interpretation of what it means to divide by 3. That's got a very important pedagogical implication is that we have to listen carefully to what sound like errors and have the kids explain to us how they got to the answer that they got to. I think one of the hard things is how you select what will provoke conflict. Sometimes teachers try to stay within mathematics to show what's wrong, and it doesn't. Somehow you have to get some other meaning to come in. So if you say something like, well, if we've got 12 and we're sharing it amongst three of us, are you going to be happy to get 1 rand 50? You're bringing in another set of meanings. They are everyday meanings in a way. I mean, something not fair about that.
I think one of the problems sometimes is that you might actually set up conflict which make people feel utterly disempowered. So they think, oh, I just don't know anything. Let's say you set up an activity and what you've done is made people realize that they're wrong. How do you get them to move from where they are to that new conception?
One of the things that one needs to do is to develop rich tasks. And they need to be rich in a number of ways. They need to be rich conceptually. In other words, you're teaching a particular disciplinary approach or whatever. So it needs to be mathematically rich. It also needs to be rich in that it enables the diversity in the class to all make a start. And then what one has to do is to work with the different levels that come. And it's hard to do that because you've got kids that get to the end point fairly quickly and others that are moving along slowly, and how do you take them along? But I think if you've got a starting point, then you've got something to work with. And then you can say, that's a good start. Now what about if you also try a negative number? You've only used positive numbers there. Now try and see if it still holds if you use negative. Then you have to go back again and say, well, will it still hold if we use fractions?
I think the other thing about a task is that the teacher has to understand the individual component, the little pieces, as it were, that would take the learners to the concept that you want to teach. So, for instance, something like questioning. You know, when you're talking about the diversity in the class, questions become very useful in trying to challenge the student to move from the level where they are to where you'd like to take them. But that means that the teacher has to understand the individual components of the task to take it there, to take the students where she'd like to take them.
You see, and that gives you two different strategies, and I think both of them are important. You'd use them differently at different times. The one would be as you break the task down yourself as the teacher. And you might spend a few periods on these small pieces and then pull them together later. The other approach is to start the other way around, is that you start from the whole problem and then you've got a harder mediating task to do while you're going around fixing up, seeing that the little pieces are being attended to. Mm. Some teachers have different styles and would work better in one direction more than the other. Some manage to do both quite effectively, and I don't think one would want to rule that one way is good in all circumstances.
So unlearning is as important as learning in good teaching. But how do teachers help learners unlearn? One way to do so is to provide some kind of conflict, and one does this through activities. Can you think of any activities that you would use to get people to unlearn misconceptions they may have?